It begins as a cautionary tale about a girl learning responsibility, and it segues surreptitiously into a story about a girl learning of her own power and her own agency and coming into her own.
It just really, really holds up. Like, the songs are great. The puppetry just looks amazing. So thanks for finally bringing Labyrinth to FlixWatcher.
The beautiful artistry, the incredible storytelling that's going on, the efficiency of it, the incredible performance, the wonderful musicality of it. I just adore it. It gets better, and in every scene there's something about this film that intrigues me and draws me in. I love it.
Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of FlixWatcher Podcast. Today we're joined by Will.
Hello.
Kevin.
How are you?
And Helen.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking about Labyrinth.
Thank you, as always, to the Mighty People for the mighty, mighty tunes. And thanks to Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills.
Please do remember to write a review and rate us on Apple Podcasts and anywhere you can do where you listen to the podcast, because it really does help us.
And you can join in the conversation with us on Twitter
at FlixWatcherPod and on Instagram
at FlixWatcher.
Hello everyone, thanks for listening today. Joining FlixWatcher, we have Will and Kevin. If you could please say hello to our listeners and tell them a little bit more about who you are and what you do, please.
Well, I'm Will, and I'm a screenwriter, and here beside me virtually is Kevin. Hello, Kevin. What do we do?
I'm also a screenwriter, and we do a podcast called The Best Bits, where we pick our favourite scenes from randomly selected, weirdly specific themes and talk nonsense.
I mean, is it nonsense? Because you guys seem to do a fair bit of research each episode, which...
We do, and people think that we're quite literate because of that, but it goes in one ear and out the other ear, because the minute that we stop recording on the episode, by the next week, we can't even remember our own names or what we discussed, so...
yeah. We literally cram in so many films for an episode that as soon as you hit stop as soon as the episode is done, it all evaporates. It's like doing, holding information for an exam.
And it just exactly. GCSEs are gone. As soon as you walk out the hall, it's like, I don't care what an integration is.
Yep.
I don't need to start ever again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's
Except,
awesome.
I mean, your subjects are a bit more interesting. You guys are talking about erotic thrillers. You're talking about, special effects. So I mean, I try and retain a bit of that to use in pub quizzes.
It's great fun. It's really interesting. And the topics have kind of gone all over the place, but it's always ended up with really fascinating and interesting and insightful, stories, really. So like some of my favorite episodes, we did one on single takes, where we just discussed our favorite single take scenes. And that was fascinating. And you kind of discover some of the heroes of single takes. One of my favorite episodes ever was Best I Love You Scene. And we both wept. It's so strange. We both cried and we both made middle-aged men making each other cry talking about our favorite beautiful. I Love You Scene. So it's a fun podcast.
I'll tell you, the one where I got very, very emotional was Best Muppet Scene. So
yes.
Well, I actually wanted to talk a bit about that in this. There's obviously a direct tie-in with this.
But there is.
You tell us about your Best Muppet Scene, because I went on after listening to the episode, I went on a bit of a deep dive.
So did I, to be honest, because I only knew the Muppets from The Muppet Show. And, I used to watch it with my dad when I was a kid. It used to be on the BBC, I think, at 6 o'clock. And I'd sit in his lap and I'd watch The Muppet Show and, it's time to face the music. And that was the extent of it, other than seeing a couple of the movies like the Muppets Take Manhattan. Mm-hmm. But for the episode, watching all of their films in order and learning about the ethos of the company and where they began and how thematic every show that he put his name to and put out into the world, how...
He being Jim Henson,
yeah, where it was like he wanted disadvantaged children to be able to get an education, so he created Sesame Street. Or he wanted to talk about capitalism and the 9-to-5 lifestyle and how pervasive that was. So he built that into Fraggle Rock. And you think, Fraggle Rock? Wow, I didn't know it was that deep, where it was, it was about the upstairs, downstairs of Muppet land. And then just... Yeah, his death, especially when all the different puppeteers who were like a family to Jim Henson came and did a tribute to him, and they built that into the actual memorial service where they had the Muppets of the Muppet Show reacting to the to Kermit not being there because that was Jim Henson's Muppet, and Fozzie trying to step into his shoes and not feeling like he was capable to do it, and the way that they sort of just were quite meta about finding a catharsis to his loss, I found so moving. And it just made me a massive fan of the original Jim Henson Muppets and all the puppeteers that were part of that legacy. It's slightly diverged away from that now with the Disney corporatization of the Muppet brand. But where it began originally and its cultural footprint, I think, is remarkable and marvelous.
Mm. It's massive. I mean, the deep dive I went into, which I'm going to kind of pull on here, talk about this film, Labyrinth, is like how the hell did they do that?
Yeah.
In so many pages, how the hell did they do that? I mean, which one of you guys chose Labyrinth?
It was me, Corby.
No worries. So, Will, can you tell us why you chose Labyrinth? Give us a synopsis. I'll get the time ready for a 1 minute synopsis. And then we'll go into the how the hell did they do that of Labyrinth.
Why I chose it is because it's a film that I saw when I was really young on VHS, and it transfixed me because of the incredible artistry that's on screen. It's a very much a classical fairy tale. At the time, I watched it many, many times, but it never stood out as, it was never as great as like a Star Wars or anything like that, but yet it was a film that I went back to over and over again. And as the years have gone on, I appreciate it more and more. And I realized when I went to look at it on my letterbox, I realized I'd logged it maybe 10 years ago, whenever, as a 3-star film. And now I'm going, this is close to a 5-star film. It's a 4-star film. It's going up in my estimations as I get older, because as I get older now, I'm seeing...
Or as films get worse.
Deeper... But I'm seeing the beautiful artistry, the incredible storytelling that's going on, the efficiency of it, the incredible performance, the wonderful musicality of it. I just adore it. It gets better, and in every scene there's something about this film that intrigues me and draws me in. I love it.
And let's get the synopsis timer up, ready, go.
Okay, so Labyrinth is a magical musical fairy tale directed by Jim Henson, with music by David Bowie. It's about a fairy tale obsessed teenage girl, Sarah, played by Jennifer Connelly before Top Gun Maverick, who is forced to babysit her little brother Toby by her wicked stepmother. She's frustrated at being trapped in a world so mundane and lacking in magic. She summons the Goblin King to take her baby brother away. And when the Goblin King actually does it, she is given 13 hours to solve a labyrinth and rescue him. Utilizing the incredible talents of his cast of puppeteers, Jim Henson creates a rich world of magic and wonder filled with unforgettable characters such as the fairy-killing goblin Hoggle, the red-haired giant Sir Didymus, the Junk Lady, and, of course, David Bowie's Goblin King Jareth and his hypnotic crotch.
I'm assuming everyone here has seen it at least once before.
Yep.
Correct.
Absolutely.
Just double-checking. And I had a blind spot with... The Princess Bride, for example. So
a 5-star classic.
Well, the first time I saw it was for Flixwatcher.
Wow.
But anyway, that's good. I just want to check just where we are. So go on, Kevin.
I can tell you one thing that I took away from watching it this time that I wasn't really tapped into when I originally saw it, is that it begins as a cautionary tale about a girl learning responsibility. And it segues surreptitiously into a story about a girl learning of her own power and her own agency and coming into her own. And I think they're doing a nice sleight of hand there, where her arc isn't to become the responsible babysitter, but it's actually to realize that men, like this sex lord, doesn't have any power over her. It's she has the power, and it's only what she gives him is the power that he has over her.
Man, I'm telling you, watching it this time, I only got that message. Like on this recent viewing, it's a cautionary tale to young women or young people about their first toxic relationship. Jared is a gaslighter. He's this he's this rock star toxic boyfriend that she I'm so vibing with that, Kevin.
Did you notice that when she's in her bedroom on the sort of the wall of inspiration that she has, there's a photograph of her stepmother with David Bowie?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the first time.
Everything from the film is in that room. So there's even a like statue of him as well. Like everything's there.
Absolutely.
I wonder what that means, though. Does she have a crush on her stepmother's ex-husband.
You're suggesting this was a dream and wasn't a real life?
Sort of a Wizard of Oz thing of like taking
definitely
the characters in real life and creating fairy tale avatars for them.
Because the Wizard of Oz book, in that room that you see the Wizard of Oz sitting there, it's very prominent as the camera, as the camera pans, is very prominently there. I think it's, she is a young thespian. Her mother is obviously, from those little scrapbook and things that are on her mirror, you can see that she, her mother is this Broadway star or something
like
that. And or, no, her mother. Her stepmother is a mundane mother. Her stepmother is the one that's in the relationship with the real life David Bowie.
Oh, okay. Now it's getting even more complicated.
Yes. So she is, and she, you can see that Sarah, Jennifer Connelly's character is, she's obsessed with fairy tales.
Wait, so.
But she's actually obsessed with acting.
Wait.
That's
so
what she's
into. Mother, who's no longer around, was an actress.
Yes.
She also wants to be an actress. And her mother once starred in something with David Bowie, with Jared. And that's who she's fantasizing about?
She was in a relationship with Jared
I don't think this has ever been confirmed, has it?
Well, guys, as you're listening now, do delve into Wikipedia after this episode. Tell us whether Kevin's right or wrong.
Look at those clips that she has hanging, the scrapbook stuff. It's all there in the headlines, like these tabloid headlines.
So it's almost like a Usual Suspects thing, you're saying. The story's kind of built up from there.
It's all there. Every element is there.
Do you know what I did notice as well with the beginning of the film is it obviously begins in England in some sort of manor estate where she's like acting out or she's reciting some lines from a play, and then she realizes, oh, I'm late, and she runs around the corner, and then it cuts to Oregon or wherever it is, and you can just tell the geography and the topography is completely different.
Yeah, I was thinking, where is, what kind of home, what kind of place is that in the States? That she just runs across in the pissing rain.
It looks like Oregon to me.
No, I mean where the like the stately home place was that almost looks like it would have a maze in it that wouldn't be typical in the States.
No, well, it's like in Batman, isn't it? Where he has a manor house and he lives in Gotham, like Chicago. It's like, where is that exactly?
One thing that did strike me as you're talking, Kevin, about the kind of allegory in this film, surprisingly, as all this mayhem's going on, and I remember the kind of the Escher-esque staircase.
Loved it.
So and all this, I haven't seen it for like 2 decades, or at least 10 years. And when you said it then, one of the most striking memories for me was the stop. David Bowie says, before she says, you have no power with me.
Yeah.
That, even though maybe you didn't understand what was going on there, the subtext of it, that still managed to cut through as a youngling, for me at least, because I was always kind of really transfixed by that scene where he's like literally like,
it's like what
really
you tell kids.
Hold it back.
It's only a nightmare. It's not real. It can't hurt you. And funnily enough, it's quite similar to Nightmare on Elm Street, where Nancy learns that Freddy Krueger has no power over her, and she can turn her back on him, and that neutralizes his threat.
Helen, Labyrinth, where do you sit?
So this was one of my favorite films from the 80s. Fond memories of watching it on VHS. At some point, it would have been a few years after it had come out, obviously, for VHS and for it to trickle down. And I mean, I loved it. Obviously, very mesmerized by Bowie, and also wishing that maybe the Goblin King could take away my younger brothers as well, who were much younger. But yeah, my
would you have rescued them if he did?
Fuck him.
I mean, I would have been tempted to go into the
about a week later.
The labyrinth. I mean, it all looked pretty cool. They were also terrified of the fieries having. The nightmares about having their head ripped off by the fireys was a reoccurring nightmare for him. So, but I've watched it a lot at various points, quite a lot during student days as well, just as something to kind of quote along and basically get stoned to and laugh at all the kind of like silliness about it. And then, just later on, particularly around when Bowie died and certain anniversaries around there, because I'm a huge Bowie fan, but it just really, really holds up. Like, the songs are great, and I think we'll probably chat about it, but the CGI owl is impressive for its time, but obviously clearly stands out as being CGI, whereas
it's
everything else is obviously done puppetry. Just looks amazing. And then when you kind of like watch it now, like seeing like Ron Muick's name up, who I know mainly as being an artist and obviously like one of the key puppetry people and you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense to it now. But I can't believe it's taken, what, 250 something episodes to get Labyrinth on it. So thanks for finally bringing Labyrinth to FlixWatcher.
Did you guys had an episode about early CGI, am I right? Or is that, or
special effects, SFX.
Special effects.
Yeah, we had Dan Martin on who does a lot of monster effects and things like that.
Because I remember when that owl came in and being super transfixed with it as a kid, thinking, wow, this is the future. Even though obviously it pales in comparison to, you know, I'm just watching Encanto again with my son for the 100th time, which is always great.
But you know the big difference between when we were on that episode, we were talking about the tactile nature of special effects, that even if they don't look realistic, you know that you can touch it. You know that there's a texture to that. There was some sort of TikTok that was going around recently, which was quite memorable, which said, your tongue knows what everything feels like. And if you picture anything like a pillow or a piece of plastic, your tongue knows what that feels like. And I think
that's so weird.
It's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I think that applies as well to special effects. So with this film, this is one of those films that I would have watched as a kid, and I would have loved to have been just there on the day shooting it. Those sets, those little hovels and all the puppets and stuff. And you just don't have that anymore, where today it's like a warehouse and it's all green, or it's, you know, blue foam, and that's standing in for like a buggy or something that people are meant to be riding on. Yeah.
I think I picked Hoggle, the creation of Hoggle, as my favorite practical effect, because the actual creation of Hoggle is an amazing work of collaborative art, because you have a small performer in the suit who has to you know, act physically but also turn the head. You have then four remote puppeteers who are operating the face, one of which is also doing the voice, and they all had to work together in perfect synchronicity to make that performance come alive. And it does. Hoggle has, you feel the complexity of the character of Hoggle so deeply in this film. It's just gets so much better and better and better when you realize this is all done in camera, in the moment. It's beautiful stuff.
Well, I love bits where the, I can't remember his name, the guy who lives in the bog,
Sir Didymus?
Yeah, Sir Didymus.
Yeah. Oh, Sir Didymus. Yeah. Yes.
When he's riding the dog in the wide cuts, it's obviously riding a dog, but in close... Yeah, close up, the dog is a puppet.
It's a Muppet. Really funny.
And I don't think that would have registered as a kid when watching that. But even though it registered now, it's like, oh, that's really cool. It didn't take me out of it in the way that other things would. I mean, I always talk about
they had
the first Jumanji.
In the puppet suit to perform the puppet. It was a Jack Russell.
A small it was dog Jim inside. Henson's. Jim Henson's pet dog, of course, had to be a puppeteering dog.
But I talk about things like Jumanji, where I first saw that, and I thought the CGI just looked terrible. And I just thought, I think I watched the film once and never wants to watch it again.
And it just gets worse and worse as the years pass.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the CGI. It's such a shame.
I think for Labyrinth, because it does so well in its scene building and everything else generally, that those bits where it's clearly a puppet or clearly something else, because everything else is done so well, that your brain probably was just like, I accept this. Yeah. I'm going to be cool with that.
Yeah.
It's also just filled with great ideas. Like when she falls down the well and it's all the hands are grabbing
hands.
Her and they're making their hands into, they're doing like, they're doing like what you see in like a circus or a fun fair, to make these faces and communicate with her. It's like everything just feels like there's a lot of talent behind the screen that's making this come alive.
Yeah, absolutely. And every scene, there's something, there's a little detail in the corner of every scene that just, you know, enriches it. Like, for instance, when they're in that tunnel near the end and this, what's it called, that machine is coming towards them, like just spinning with this drill, and they just get out the way and the drill passes them, and you see it's just these two goblins like routine, and they're not like men, they're not evil goblins, they're just like, oh, keep spinning, and it just
the movie extends beyond what you see, and you feel like, I could just walk around that corner and just follow those guys and see what they're up to.
Absolutely.
One of the things I asked before we joined was, could this film be made now? Could this film be made today? And I don't think it could be, for a few different reasons. One, based on the fact that I know they were trying to do like a Gremlins 3, but they were like, well, you'd have to do it in CGI. And everyone's like, no, you can't do Gremlins in CGI. But then if it's to be done in a puppet Gremlins, even though obviously Gremlins are real and they exist and so are Mogwais, but if they're so traditional Gremlins, then it would just cost so much, you know, for housing and rearing and, you know, upkeep of the Gremlins. I would imagine it'd be a similar thing. I know they did the Dark Crystal
and it cost
Netflix,
a fortune.
That got canned, didn't it? Yeah.
No Bowie, no Labyrinth. Just them's the rules.
Well, I mean,
something like this. I mean, like something akin to this.
Yeah.
And I think, unfortunately, back in the day, these Jim Henson's live action films, they bombed. Like, this didn't make money. Dark Crystal didn't make money. And they weren't successful at the time. He was always scrambling to, you know, keep the puppeteers employed. Mm-hmm. And now in the universe where Disney own an awful lot of the Muppets, they're not going to invest that money and time into something that they see as like, oh, it probably won't be seen. And you really need Jim Henson driving it to bring that level of talent and execution and dedication and
but also morality.
Quite possibly, I think you're right on that. Yeah, he was the captain of all that Muppet stuff for all those decades. Absolutely.
Was this Jennifer Connelly's first film? I know you made the gag about this into Top Gun Maverick, but
I would think so. She was pretty younger than this. So.
I think she was 14.
Yeah.
She was 14, yeah. I can't remember if she was in anything before this.
Do you know one thing about this film, though, which is also helps it to stand out? It's an adventure story with a girl protagonist. There weren't that many in the 80s.
There aren't that many
to
now.
Oz, and yeah, there aren't that many now.
And she wasn't betrothed to anyone.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not about her finding love or Prince Charming or anything like that. It's really just all about her saving the day.
That's a good point.
Oh, she was in, she was in Once Upon a Time in America. She was in a few films.
Oh, right. Done some IMDb.
Yeah, she was in Dario Argento's World of Horror, a couple of other things. So I did a quick letterbox jump right there and she has...
This was definitely her breakout role, though.
I have a vague memory of her studying in England.
She's put on a British accent at some point through this, wasn't it? Was that just for the acting phases, or was that... I couldn't quite work out what was going on.
I think it was for the acting.
Yeah.
That's what I think was going on. I think she's her character, she's a frustrated thespian. That's where she is, where she wants to be. She wants to be an actor like her mother. And so that's where that's coming from. And I want to highlight one of my favorite moments in this film. And it's the junk lady, and that entire scene with the junk lady, where she has kind of like Snow White and the Seven what's it called? She gets the apple,
dwarfs.
Which sends her into puts her into a coma, and she she wakes up back in her bedroom. Mm. And I love this scene. She's back where she wants it to be. Mm-hmm. Everything's fine. All her ties are around her, and she opens the door, and there's the junk lady, and she sees, oh no, I'm still in this place. But I love what's underpinning that, like, you know, all about, you know, the junk lady is just throwing all her toys at her, keeping her distracted. And I was like going, oh crikey, that's kind of like us adults today. Like, you know, we have all these toys to keep us distracted and keep us kind of infantile.
But this is also playing into her coming of age arc, in that she's not a child anymore. That's not going to work on her.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And that's a part of her growing up. And I love the transition from the junk lady into David Bowie. Fuck, it's amazing. It's so seamless. It's like a magic trick in front of your eyes. It's amazing.
Well, that's a nice segue into the man himself, Jareth. This is my first. It's either this or watching Let's Dance somewhere on maybe on Top of the Pops. I'm just being like, who the fuck is this guy? Like, just being super transfixed. And it's, I mean, this is probably what half the people our age remember him from, mainly before they got to know the music, right? And it's kind of insane. And this is the other part of me saying, could this film be made now? Because it's like super high camp, but also serious. But everyone who watches it takes it like seriously. But I don't think that kind of set of rules would exist in a film in this day and age, though, would they?
You'd find it hard to find someone to go with it the way that he's gone with it. Being that, you know, in the 80s, being at like his peak, to go, yeah, all right, then I'm going to put on some sexy leggings and hang out with some goblins and yeah, I'll do the songs. But like, you want me to do those kind of songs? Okay, yeah, let's go for it with those songs. I just don't think anyone else, I mean, no one else can touch Bowie, but I think we'd struggle to find someone else who manages to tick all of the boxes that he does in this.
Absolutely. That's the thing. He just somehow, kind of like so much of his career, he managed to hit this almost undefinable sweet spot where you can't quantify it. It's just, he just gets it. It's just like, you know, it's sexually confusing. It's kind of like, hang on a sec, I like your Tina Turner do, but what's going on in your pants?
there's that one moment where Hoggle is sort of like in his eye line and you've just kind of got his crotch and Hoggle, that's kind of like my main memory of this film.
Did you ever see the behind the scenes stuff where it's somebody else's hand is doing the crystal ball, twirling it around their fingers, and he's sort of got his arms behind his back, and yeah, it's the classic magician's trick.
And how they trick the stair lift, the flip as well. Stairs,
yeah. That's amazing. This film is worth, if you watch the film and you haven't seen any of the behind the scenes stuff, go on YouTube and look at the behind the scenes stuff, because seeing how they pulled off these magic tricks in camera is just a delight. It's like, oh, this, I wish films were made like this. I'm so sorry I sound like an old man. I just wish films were made like this. You know, just please, in camera tricks were amazing.
They were. I also want to give a shout out to Gates McFadden, Dr. Beverly Crusher from Star Trek The Next Generation. She was the choreographer on Labyrinth.
Oh, seriously?
No way.
So the fire guys, the ones who have their heads ripped off, she choreographed all that.
It's great, great dance moves they've got. And also Danny John-Jules does the voice for one of them. So you're probably like recognising his voice.
Cat from Red Dwarf.
Yep. You're probably like, I kind of know that
and also
voice.
Barrington. Yeah. Also Barrington from Maid Marian and Her Merry Men. There we go. There's some deep cuts there for us 80s kids. Okay, guys, let's head to the scores.
I'm Sam Clements, host of the 90 Minutes or Less Film Festival, another podcast in the Stripped Media family, a podcast that celebrates movies under 90 minutes long. Each episode, I'm joined by a special guest who selects a movie to join our prestigious lineup. Past guests have included fellow Stripped Media family members Martin and Sam from Song by Song, and Kobe from Flixwatcher, and Dave from The Wire Stripped. Search for us now on the app you're currently listening to this podcast, or join us at 90minfilmfest.com.
Welcome to the Flixwatcher scores. They are always out of 5. You may have decimal places. And we will start with you, please, Will, with your recommendability out of 5.
I'm going to say 4. I'm going to say this is, I can recommend this to everyone, young and old. The only people who might not get it are people who don't like David Bowie, maybe just can't stand puppets and Muppets. But listen, this is 4 out of 5 for me.
I'm going to reiterate what Will said. I'm going to go with 4 as well. The only thing that I think doesn't hold up is how brisk the opening 10 minutes of the film are and how quickly it just gets straight into the action. I appreciate that, but I also feel like there's a little few extra scenes that could have been added in to give context to her character journey throughout the movie. But other than that, this is a belter of a film. It looks great. It's captivating. And it works on kids, and I can speak now as a middle-aged guy. It works on middle-aged men as well.
Can I reiterate that? I've shown this to my kids. I showed it to my kids a couple of years ago, and they were transfixed. And I'm always interested to see what films from the past hook my kids in. Mm. They were both, and they were young. They were like 3 and 5 or something like that. Oh, okay. And they both sat there from beginning to end, loved it.
I was going to say, one thing about the start that you were talking about there was... It moves really quickly. It doesn't set up anything. It doesn't set up who this Goblin King is, or the fact that there might be a sequence of words that can take Toby away from her.
No.
But suddenly we know that suddenly she's very close to saying it, and then there's this Goblin that are going, say it. And you're like, hold on,
it's working on dream logic almost.
Yeah.
I loved that, though. I loved that. I loved that. It's just like, just fucking, we're going with it. We're not going to get bogged down and, you know, establishing rules. Just go and we just get us in there. I love that.
And one thing I mentioned a few times is with Groundhog Day, where the director was trying to think about how this time loop occurs. And then just one day it's just like, fuck it.
Yeah, don't explain it.
It happens. Yeah,
That's plot. It's not story. All we want is story.
Helen, sorry, recommendability score.
It's clearly a 5. But it's always a fear when you go back to films that you loved, especially if they're from the 80s, and you watch them as an adult and you're like, this is a bit sketchy. Ooh, this is really, really good. But I still think that it's great. I still think there's a lot of just really, really beautiful imagery, and it's just kind of still got that appeal. And I think it's partly down to everyone involved just really wanting to make it work and really kind of leaning into the weirdness and the surrealness of it. And I mean, the only small thing I would say is that watching it as an adult, the kind of like end battle scene is a bit too long. It goes on for a bit and you're a bit like, come on, we want to get to the Goblin King. That's the only thing. But yeah, it's 5 for me.
I'm going to go for a 4.5. I think it's, was it Will or Helen that said it wasn't their favourite film growing up, but it's one they just watched loads. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like I said, it wasn't a Star Wars, for example, but you'd be happy if someone said, let's watch Labyrinth. You'd be like, yeah, let's watch Labyrinth. And I think it has shown its age a bit, but still you're like, it's a nice warm hug of a film, really. And I would be very surprised if modern youth, I say like 14 and above, if this were for the first time, what they're thinking about. I'd like to know what that kind of acid test is. Because I think potentially you have to have watched it when you're younger and you watch it through, or you first saw it like in the 80s when that's how things were done. And this was like chef's kiss of a film. Mm. But yeah, 4.5. So repeat viewing score, Will.
Oh, 5. Yes, and as I've said earlier on, I've watched this over and over and over again, and it gets better the more I've watched it, and as the older I've gotten, it's gotten better. So it's easily a 5, and there's so much to enjoy in every scene that you will actually have to go back and watch, and you take delight in finding the minutiae, the little details of like a worm in the corner. It's like, oh my god, they've put a little worm on this small little rock, and someone's managed to figure out how to puppeteer that small insect. So there's so much craft and beauty and artistry in this film. The music is the music numbers are so catchy, you can't help but hum along to them, as we've already shown. So it's a 5 for me. Absolutely, I love it.
Kevin?
Yeah, I'm going to say the same as Will. The music, if anything, you can just put this film on and leave it on in the background and just jive out to some David Bowie bangers. Yeah, this is a film that I would love to have been a character in that world. I'd love to have been a crew member on that set, and I love rewatching it. It's a, as you said, it's a hug of a film.
So which character would you want to have been then? Saying you wanted to have been a character, anyone particular?
I would love to have been Jennifer Connelly's scene partner. Age appropriate, but her scene partner.
Let's guess Helen. Repeat viewing score.
Absolutely a 5. So I actually ended up watching this like twice in like the last sort of week and a half, so it's got to be a 5.
Why did you watch it twice? Had your partner, your husband, not seen it before?
Well, obviously I watched it in prep for this, and I think you gave the film choices in very good time, so I had good time to get them in before the record. And then randomly a friend invited me to go and see it at the Lunar Cinema on Sunday, so
no way. What was that like?
Well, I'll come to that in the next score. But
good.
Will, small screen score.
Oh, I'm going to go 5 because, again, it's great on a small screen because we've got the music. As long as you can hear, if you had the smallest screen possible, you can still hear those cracking songs, those cracking tunes from David Bowie. I'm not docking this. This is 5 for me.
Kevin?
I'm going to go 4 just because small screens are not better than big screens.
Let's lean into the Lunar story here.
So I've
before we said, has anyone else seen this on a big screen?
No.
Okay, Helen.
So obviously did not see this when it came out of the cinema, and I've only ever really seen it on VHS, and then Netflix. So yeah, it was the Lunar Cinema is obviously the outdoor one. So you have to kind of get there quite late. So I was a little bit like, am I going to stay for it all? Seeing as I obviously have only watched it a few days ago, but yeah, it was good. It was nice to be in that kind of labyrinth, like love bubble where people were kind of like swaying along to the songs. And there was like a few kids there as well. And then there was a few people wearing like David Bowie kind of labyrinth t-shirts, which was nice and sweet. So yeah, it was good. But saying that, I don't know how much it added to it. Obviously the ambience was good, but having spent all of my life watching it on the small screen, I'll give it a 4.5 for small screen.
I'm going to go for a 4. I'd like to see some of the big screen. I'd like to see it at the Prince Charles Cinema.
I think it's a quote along they do with that one. So everyone kind
I'm
of
sure, yeah,
it's sings.
A quote along and sing along. And I think I've said this before, when I've seen films for the first time on a big screen, typically at Prince Charles, it adds a whole new kind of vibe to it. Like I didn't realize how funny Gremlins was until I watched it on screen, and watching Die Hard, you know, for the first time with people was insane. Even though both of those films had been VHS or copied off Channel 4 or whatever back in the 80s. So I hadn't had the opportunity. It'd just been me and my brother, or just me watching it by myself. So I think this would be good to see with other people, long story short. And that's why I give it a slightly smaller, small screen score. But like everyone else here, it seems like we've had that kind of taped off TV, or if you were lucky, bought or rented VHS, pristine quote-unquote copy. So we've always done with inferior copies versus what we have now on Netflix, I guess.
Yeah.
I bought her off iTunes in LA once because it was available. Wow. And I had a meeting with the Henson Company. That was why. Okay. And I thought I would go back and revisit it because I wasn't as...
Beautiful name drop there. I love that. Karen.
Yeah. Gadoosh. And really enjoyed it. And I still have that copy on my iTunes or Apple, whatever the fuck it is now.
Some still cloud there. Somewhere. Can you access it?
It's standard definition though, which is a...
Engagement score. Will.
It's 5. It's like this is so engaging from the off. It doesn't sag as you were, Kevin was complaining about it kind of like being a bit too quick in its opening. I find it's like it just gets in there and it just gets into the world, and we're in this wonderful world of Labyrinth, and I'm sucked in absolutely from the get go, no question about it. So it's a 5.
Kevin,
I'm going to give it a 1.
Oh, stop there. Lying.
That got you all engaged. What I was going to say, yeah, 5. You know, it just casts a spell over you, and it's I'm coming back to what you said. It's a lovely hug of a film, and yeah, I think that perfectly describes this film.
Helen,
yes, I'm also going to go for a 5. And even if you've seen it like loads of times, new things kind of stick out. So there's a part in it where the you know, there's those like little creatures that are turning the stones around. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you listen to it, one of them says, "Your mother is a fucking aardvark," which you'll only know if you've like watched it loads and loads of times. And I've listened to it a lot of times and I'm like, they are saying that. And like when they're kind of doing, there's some other like ones where they're like talking gibberish. But if you like listen hard enough, you're like, what are they actually saying? They're actually saying like different things. So yeah, that's the kind of engagement you get. And one of the last times I watched it, watch it with the subtitles on, and then you can sing along perfectly with all the songs when they come on.
I watched everything with subtitles on, actually.
Old no, man.
Your mother is like, a fragging aardvark. I've just typed it.
Listen to
a fracking aardvark.
Listen back to it, because it's like, it's one of those ones where it's like, snuck that one in.
He would have been actually in prep for Fraggle Rock at this time as well.
Potentially, yeah.
So, yeah. Because they were trying to come up with a name for that show. It was like, what are we going to call them? Fraggles.
Engagement score for me, I'm going to 4.5. I was quite interested to see how much I could just let it wash over me, like I said, the warm hug. So that gives us an overall score of, it's hefty, 4.65. 625. It's up there. It's not at the top. It's not in the top 10. I will, whilst we're reading out the Twitter scores, I'll go to our score board and give an estimate of where that might sit. But guys, do follow us on Twitter because we put out a tweet. Well, first of all, follow us on Twitter because
why not?
It's nice, you know, follow us. You can hear about what we're doing. You hear about the latest episodes coming out. But we always put a shout out before we record, and that gives you an opportunity to give your opinion about the film. So in this case, I put a tweet out saying, we're reviewing Labyrinth with Kevin Lehane and Willems Films from Best Bits Pod. Have you seen it? Give us your thoughts and a score out of 5 stars for an on-air shout out on FlixWatcher. And we had 2 responses. Will, do you want to take the first one?
Yeah, I got the first one. It's actually from Patrick McGinley, who's one of our Patreon members of the Best Bits Pod. Patrick says, 5 stars, obviously. I think about this character a lot, and he's referring to the Junk Lady, and he's got a beautiful image of the Junk Lady there. She piles all these old toys onto Sarah's back, weighing her down. She is like pop culture, feeding us endless nostalgia. When Sarah rejects her, the illusion is shattered. One of the best scenes in the movie for me. So yeah. Great point out.
I read that earlier and I was like, it's beautiful.
We love Patrick.
We love Patrick too.
Patrick come back.
Bye. this is from the podcast Nobody Asked For. And they say, it's my go-to rainy day feel-good movie. It's just fun. And fun with Henson and David Bowie, which is the best kind of fun. An easy 5 stars.
So in our top scoring films, overall score, is still... When Harry Met Sally joint top film, When Harry Met Sally and The Fugitive. And they have a score of 4.78125 each. And then we go to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So this is number 9.
Ooh, in the top 10. That's great.
And just beneath The Big Lebowski. And above a film called Invitation, which is just knocked off the top 10 spot, which I didn't realize was that high, but we obviously really enjoyed Invitation. Fantastic. Well done, Will. Not this competition to bring the best film in.
Hey, I want to actually share some of the credit with Kevin because I was going through it and Kevin said to me, how about Labyrinth? And I went, oh shit, yeah, because I was trying to find a film that wasn't, that you haven't covered already. So thanks as well, Kevin.
Anyway, Kevin and Will, can you sign up by telling us where we can find you guys online, your podcast, and say goodbye to all the listeners?
Well, our podcast is called The Best Bits Pod. You can find us on all your podcast providers. We're on Twitter, Kevin. What's our Twitter handle?
At Best Bits Pod.
Hey.
Yeah. But the podcast is not called The Best Bits Pod. The podcast is called The Best Bits.
The podcast is called The Best Bits Podcast. The Best Bits. I should know the name, proper
with
name
Will
of
and
my
Kevin.
Podcast. That's awesome. Yeah.
Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us again. We've had you on before. So, guys, if you're listening for the first time and hearing Kevin and Will's voices, you want to hear more of them. What films did you bring up before? I can't remember off the top of my head.
I think it was Fargo. No, it wasn't The Karate Kid and No Country for All Men.
I had The Karate Kid and you had No Country for All Men.
Yeah, fantastic. So if you want to hear those guys talking about films, go to their podcast and also dig deeper into the FlixWatcher barrels and hear the previous episodes. But thank you very much, guys. It's been a pleasure to have you on again.
Thank you.
Great to be on. Thank you for having us.
Bye.
Bye.
Enjoyed this episode of FlixWatcher Podcast? Why not leave us a 5-star review on iTunes? You can also follow us at FlixWatcherPod on Twitter and we're at FlixWatcher on Instagram. Thanks as always to the Mighty People for their mighty, mighty tunes and Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills. If you're looking to get your podcast edited as sweet as this, get in touch with Ben and that's Rockwood, R-O-K-K Wood Audio. Tell them FlixWatcher sent you.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.